Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Author journalist Michael Pollan has earned honors and accolades for his work on the American food system, how we eat, and why much of what we eat is bad for us. He has taken on the American food industry overall, including corporate farms and the meat processing system, and branded them as villains in what's wrong with the American food diet and what's making us obese and unhealthy. His previous books include In Defense of Food, Omnivore's Dilemma, and Food Rules. He's coming at it now from a different direction in his latest book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. In it, he looks at food not from the field, farm, or fast food counter, but from the kitchen. He says that cooking or transforming foods from their natural state to the plate can help reform what and the way we eat. I'm Don Marsh. Pollan was in town last week for the Maryville Talks book series. It was my pleasure to interview him on stage during the event at Chaminade and ask about what got him into the kitchen.
Yeah, I wasn't setting out to write a book about cooking. It was, I've been following the food chain now for a dozen years or so. And Omnivore's Dilemma was really a look at the earth end of the food chain, agriculture and how we bring plants and animals out of the earth to eat. And then I jumped ahead, because readers were asking me a lot of questions about health, to looking at the body end of the food chain, which is to say, what happens in our bodies once we ingest this stuff. And I hadn't really paid that much attention to what happens in the middle, because it seemed like it was in plain sight. I mean, that's what I knew the most about, in a way. I cooked, and we saw that all around us. But the more I studied both agriculture and health, the more I realized that these transformations we call cooking or food processing, that's what we call it when corporations do it. It's very interesting. We have two different words for the same thing. McDonald's doesn't cook. Who thinks of them as a cook? So, but that had a profound influence both on agriculture and on health. And the way we're eating or who's processing our food really is determining what kind of agriculture we're going to have. And it really was the rise of the fast food industry that led to the industrialization of our agriculture. And the desire for uniformity and the desire for very cheap meat all grew out of who was cooking or who was not cooking. So I came to see that this great movement to revive small-scale, diversified agriculture was going to top out if people stop cooking, and we are stopping cooking. And then on the other side, I came to see that the best predictor of your health is not any particular nutrient, good or bad, or even calories, but it really is who's cooking your food. Is it a corporation or is it a human being? And if it's a corporation, the chances are you're going to be struggling with all the issues that we're struggling with, obesity, type 2 diabetes, because corporations don't cook very well. So between the two, I really saw I had to complete this arc, and this now does complete the story of the food chain from farm to body that I've been working on.
As you pointed out on several occasions in the book, the food industry really makes quite a point of making sure that they do the cooking for you. I mean, that's their whole thrust, isn't it?
The food industry has been working very hard to insinuate itself into our kitchens for more than 100 years. I mean, it goes back to Betty Crocker and before Betty Crocker, really. I mean, that was what she was about. She didn't really exist, but I mean, that was an attempt. She was smuggling processed food ingredients into home cooking. And, you know, some of those are fine. I mean, I'm not like, when I say processed food, there are kinds of processed food that are real boons, I think. Frozen vegetables, canned vegetables, canned tomatoes, all these kind of things are really helpful in the kitchen. But there's another kind of processing, which is what I call ultra-processed or hyper-processed foods that have five or more ingredients usually and are meant to be whole meals, home meal replacements, as the industry calls it. But there was a lot of resistance to the effort of the food industry to cook for us. A lot of people felt like, no, this is something that happens in the home. And women in particular rejected it for a very long time. And the industry kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And they really got their opening in the 60s and 70s when women went to work in great numbers. And feminism ignited a very important conversation about the division of labor in the house. And it was a really uncomfortable conversation. And, many of us had it. And who was going to, now that women were working, who was going to do the household chores and the cooking and the child care and all this kind of stuff. And it was not a comfortable conversation. And the food industry saw it as an opportunity. And they leapt forward and said, don't argue anymore. We got you covered. We'll do it. And they took out billboards. KFC took out a billboard that kind of says it all. A giant bucket of fried chicken, you know, enough for six people or whatever, four people. And then the words, two words, women's liberation. So they kind of defined not cooking as a very progressive thing to do. It was really, really clever. And, you know, we all succumbed. Women who don't work, their rates of cooking have fallen also by half. And we have this option now, and it's very attractive to a lot of people.
You know, you say we all succumbed. We were chatting before coming out on stage, and it's not just us. I mean, you're talking about the Chinese are buying your books and people in some very large countries that are have been influenced by our food industry.
Well, yeah. I mean, right now in China, we are, you know, which has developed this incredible appetite for meat. And as they've gotten more affluent, the thing people want, they want a car, they want an iPhone, and they want meat. And to satisfy the demand for meat now, we're exporting our hog agriculture. And Chinese come here to learn how to grow pork the way we grow it. And they actually, you know, export the genetics. They bring boars and sows over, and so they're duplicating our, you know, pretty unsustainable. I mean, you guys know in Missouri, there's a lot of this up north kind of pork production, indoor CAFO, confined animal feeding operations, huge pollution problems, serious animal welfare problems. But yeah, I mean, the way Americans eat is becoming the way the world eats.
And you theorize in your book that it may have been in China that man discovered cooked meat.
It may. There is a legend to that effect, which is kind of wonderful. One of the things I do in this book is try, as I like to do, to drill down and find the origins of things we take for granted. And there's some wonderful legends about how we learn to cook. One is Lamb. It's Lamb's idea, right? I forget his first name, but he tells a story about a peasant, a Chinese peasant named Bobo, and he's a young guy and he's working for his father, and he's taking care of this litter of pigs, and they're in his house. And you know the symbol for China, right? There's an ideogram, which is or pictogram, which is a house with a pig in it, and that's prosperity or China. I forget. And so his house with the pigs in it burns down, and he goes in to try to rescue the pigs, and they're like crisped. And he reaches down to see if one is dead, and touches the skin, and puts it to his mouth, and he goes, "Whoa." Crackling, right? I mean, this is the first experience of crackling. And his father comes home and he's outraged and says, you know, you burned down the house. And he says, yeah, but Dad, check this out. Mm-hmm. And they ate that pig, and they were, this is like so far superior to, I guess they were eating raw pig. I don't know what they were eating. And it is a legend, I hope I made clear. And they decide, well, they've got to do this again. So they start building houses, filling them with pigs and burning them down. And gradually they figured out that you could, as Lamb says, Charles Lamb says, you could dress a pig without burning down an entire house. So that's one legend. But another is, you know, Freud has a story about how we discovered fire too, which is kind of insane. It's just as insane. He says that in Civilization and Its Discontents, that the control of fire only happen when men learn to resist the urge, the apparently irrepressible urge, to pee on any fire they saw and extinguish it with their stream of urine. And when we learn to resist this urge, repression is all, you know, for him, we then had this amazing advance of civilization. I mean, what was that guy smoking?
Sometimes,
actually, we know.
Sometimes a fire is just a fire, right?
Yeah.
That's what he's got to figure out. You know, I brought that up because of the importance of that discovery, that cooking meat really made a difference and probably in many ways led to the evolution of our society, our civilizations.
Yeah.
That's one of the more fascinating aspects of this book, among many.
Well, there is. This is a kind of recent hypothesis in anthropology that's fascinating that I talk about in the book. A man at Harvard named Richard Wrangham, who's a primatologist and an anthropologist. You know, anthropologists have been trying to figure out how, when we diverge from the apes, the other apes. And at a certain moment, our brains got a lot bigger than apes of a comparable size, and our digestive apparatus, our gut, got a lot smaller, although it's now going in the opposite direction. And so what accounted for this? And his hypothesis, which is, you know, seems to be accepted now, is that it was the invention of cooking. Because when you cook food, you essentially externalize part of the digestive process. You begin to break it down outside the body. And so, therefore, you don't have to use as much of your own energy to process it. And cooked food is just more digestible. It's also safer. And then there are all these foods that can only be eaten if they're cooked, like tubers, like cassava and potatoes, need to be cooked. So when we learned how to cook, we had access to this bonus amount of calories that other animals couldn't have access to, because animals, other animals don't cook, with an exception I'll get to, I hope. So we also didn't, cooked food doesn't have to be chewed as much. And Wrangham says that apes our size typically spend about 6 hours a day in the simple act of chewing their food. That's why they don't get much done. How much can you get done if you're spending 6 hours a day chewing? So this is a huge boon, and it probably marks the time when we develop these big, complex brains. But it also led to the meal. You know, the meal, once you have fire, is a cooperative thing that really advances, really starts, inaugurates civilization. Because once you have this fire, someone has to tend it while the other person is hunting or preparing the food. And then you sit around it and imagine a group of animals sitting around something incredibly desirous, this piece of meat, withholding the urge not to pee on it, but to but to eat it, and for the strongest to get it all. And so you suddenly need these rules to govern this now cooperative activity. And you need conversation, and all sorts of things flow out of that change in the way of eating. Because when you were, you know, other animals don't have meals. They don't need meals. They eat where they find the food, and that's it.
You're listening to author-journalist Michael Pollan talking about his new book, Cooked, during his appearance last Thursday at Chaminade as part of the Maryville Talks book series. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Michael Pollan. We're talking about his book, Cooked, and his effort to reform the American food system.
You broke the book down into four different categories: fire, water, air, and earth. Give us the Cliff Notes version of that.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to figure out, I was trying to get to the fundamentals of cooking. What is this thing all really about? And I realized that you could divide almost all kinds of foods that are cooked into these as the result of one or more of these four transformations. Fire is what I just described, basically putting meat on fire. And for that section, and in each section I found a master to apprentice myself to, somebody who was really good at it, who was willing to teach me, take me under his or her arm and wing or wherever, and instruct me in how to do it really well. So for fire, I went to Eastern North Carolina, which has a kind of barbecue style that I think is, I don't want to say it's the best and offend anybody in St. Louis, but is really good. But it's just primordial. It's whole hog over wood fire, no sauce, really simple and beautiful. And so I went and apprenticed myself to a barbecue pit master. And then in water, that's cooking in pots, which represents a quantum leap up from cooking simply with fire. It only happens about 10,000 years ago when you have a ceramic pottery that you can boil water in, that can withstand the flame. And when you can boil, suddenly you can do other things. You can combine different plants and create new flavors by mixing an aromatic plant with herbs or spices. You also don't lose any nutrients. You don't have that dripping of fat on the fire, which is an enormous waste. Everything is collected, and what you get as a result after long cooking is that the bonus of sauce. That's the dividend of pot cooking. It also allows you to make food soft. And you can make porridges and gruels. You can use grain for the first time, and that's why it arises at the same time as agriculture. And you can keep people alive longer, because when you can make soft foods like soups and porridges, people who've lost their teeth don't have to die anymore, which they did. So you lengthen the human lifespan. And pot cooking is the basis of all the cultural differences in our food. You know, cooking with fire is kind of the same anywhere, and if you had blindfold on, you really couldn't tell if this was Argentine barbecue or American barbecue or Australian barbecue. But as soon as you're cooking in pots, you're using a base of vegetables, of aromatic vegetables, onions, carrots, celery, or onions, peppers, and tomato, or scallions, ginger, and garlic. And each of those base vegetables immediately tells you where you are in the world, culinarily speaking. Mm-hmm. So you start getting these cultural, food becomes culturally identified. And you have the basis of all this wonderful cuisine that grows out of pot cooking.
Can I just interrupt for one
please.
Second? Because I was sort of startled when I was reading this part of the book, because you were talking about how much salt you would put on the meat.
Yes.
Prior. And I said, is this Michael Pollan, you know, the guy who thinks sodium is public enemy number one? And he's saying, use all the salt you want. And the reason for that is really fascinating.
Well, yeah, I do think, I mean, that's one of the contrarian things I learned from my teachers in that section of the book, which is that you should use, one authority said you should use 5 times as much salt as you think is appropriate. That's a dangerous recommendation. But first of all, most of the salt in our diet is from processed food. 80% of the sodium in your diet, you're not putting into your diet. So to the extent you can get off processed food, you can salt your own food as liberally as you want. It's remarkable how much salt is in processed food. But the reason to salt heavily and early, and you have to do both, and this is when you're cooking meat, is that if you salt, say, a day or even 2 days in advance, something very interesting happens at the chemical level, which is that the salt draws liquid out of the cells of the meat, and then it mingles with the salt and whatever other herbs or pepper or whatever you have on the surface. And that liquid out there, you know, mixes around. And then a vacuum has been created in the cells, a kind of osmotic vacuum. And then that very flavorful liquid is now drawn back in. So you have to salt really early to penetrate. And when you do this, the meat doesn't taste salty. It just tastes really flavorful. And this is one of the keys to good restaurant cooking, is that they do salt very early. So I found 2, even 3 days in advance is actually good. And if you can't do it, so let's say you've just bought this meat and you're cooking it now and you only have an hour to salt it, you probably shouldn't salt it at all. You should just salt it on the table because it doesn't have time to do this. It'll just dry out.
Well, you indicated that if you just lay off the processed food and all the sodium therein, you can do this and you're probably still not taking as much sodium.
No, you're still not. Yeah, it's still not going to be anywhere near what you would get in processed food.
I took you away from water.
No, that's okay.
We have air.
That was one of my practical lessons. There are a handful of very practical. I mean, this is not a cookbook. This is not going to. It doesn't have a bunch of 20-minute recipes to help you get food on the table. It's more, I don't do how-to. I do kind of how-to-think-about-it books. Although there are 4 recipes. I mean, that are one for each transformation. But they're not 20 minutes. Some of them are 20 hours. Sorry. So then baking. That was air. Basically, bread is aerated porridge, right? A good loaf of bread has got about 80% air in it. And I love bread, so I was very eager to write about bread. And bread, of course, has been the basis of the diet in the West for most of European history. It was about half the calories in the diet. And I had never thought of baking this way, but baking is a really ingenious technology for really improving the flavor, digestibility, and nutritional value of grass seeds, because that's what bread is made from, is grass seeds. You could not live on flour, a scientist told me who I interviewed, a guy at UC Davis. You would die if that's all you had to eat, flour and water. But you could live on the bread made from that flour and water. So why is that? And it's because of this technology, and it has 2 steps to it. The first is the sourdough culture that you use to leaven bread. But remember, before we had instant yeast, that's what everybody used, and everybody still should use. It's so far superior to instant yeast. And those yeasts do a very interesting thing. Basically, a grass seed is a pantry, a fully stocked pantry for the creation of a new plant. It's got everything a new life needs. It's got, you know, the right amount of protein, carbohydrates, fats, and minerals. But they're locked up really tight in these polymers and in these chelated minerals, and because the seed wants to protect itself from animals that might want to eat it, like us. So we came up with a way to overcome that, and that was the sourdough fermentation. And the bacteria and the fungi in the fermentation put out these enzymes that break down those long polymers of starch and protein into amino acids and sugars, and that makes them much more accessible to us. And they also open up the minerals. And then when you bake it, the next step happens, and that is that, you know, in a pot, porridge can't get any hotter than the boiling point. Nothing can get hotter than the boiling point. But the bread itself becomes a pressure cooker. And the steam in the little pockets of air that have been created by the yeasts and the bacteria get really hot. They can get much hotter than they ever could get in a pot. And thoroughly cooking the starch, gelatinizing the starch, it's called. And this makes it much more flavorful, much more nutritious. And the result is this, you know, this beautiful thing called bread that people, you know, could live on. So anyway, I spent a lot of time learning how to make bread. First white bread, and then when I learned about what a waste of calories white bread is, began learning how to make whole grain bread, which is a lot more challenging, but also more rewarding.
You found some interesting things about Wonder Bread, speaking of white bread not being very good for you.
Yeah. Well, I went to a Wonder Bread factory. I wanted to see how you could make a bread in like 2 hours or however. They can leaven a bread faster than you wouldn't believe, basically by using vast amounts of yeast and then a bunch of other chemicals. So I went to a Wonder Bread factory in Sacramento, and on the same day, I went to a artisanal baker who was making, you know, 400 whole grain breads a week to sell at the farmer's market in Chico, California. And the Wonder Bread plant was making 155,000 loaves of various kinds of, you know, nutritionally fortified breads. And the interesting thing was, there were a few interesting things. One was, though, that Wonder Bread's out of business. And this artisanal baker, who you thought was the past, turns out he's not the past. Wonder Bread's the past. But that bread, which has, you know, 30 or 40 different ingredients. I bought one when they went out of business. I think in January they declared bankruptcy and stopped making Wonder Bread. And I ran to the supermarket to buy a loaf because it's so iconic. I wanted to have the last Wonder Bread. And I can report to you that as of last weekend, it was still totally soft from January. It hadn't gotten stale and it hadn't gotten moldy. I don't know what it tastes like. I don't want to taste it. But it holds up really well.
Well, as did the famous Twinkie that you had in your desk.
Yes, I know. I've done this experiment before. You're right.
Yeah, but the Twinkie is long gone.
Everybody squeezed my... I had a Twinkie that lasted for 2 years without getting hard. But everybody squeezed it, so it got flattened out. They're gone, too. It's the same company.
Yeah, right, exactly. And we're very familiar with it here in St. Louis. The last category is the one that I found personally most satisfying. This whole idea of microbes and bacteria and what they do to food and what they do inside our bodies. It was just so darned educational. I loved that section.
Well, I think it was my most, for me, it was the most interesting section to work on, too, because it was things I just didn't know. I mean, think of it, a kind of cooking involving no heat whatsoever that basically involves using microbes, bacteria and fungi, to transform food. And this was the primary means of preservation before we had refrigeration. Every culture fermented food. They might ferment milk, and that's what cheese is, or they might ferment cabbage, which is sauerkraut or kimchi, or they might ferment pickles. You know, any kind of vegetable could be fermented. And they were, because that was the only way to get through the winter. But all you need to do, I mean, it's remarkable how this happens. If you just take a cabbage and slice it really thin, like you're making coleslaw, salt it, again, fairly heavily, but not, I mean, till it's, I mean, as I put it in the book, till it feels salted, not salty, which is personal, but you'll know when you're hit that point. And and then bruise it with your fingers like this, and then put it in a crock or a mason jar, and it will spontaneously ferment. And there are bacteria lurking on every leaf waiting for that bruising, the breach of the cell walls, to start digesting the sugars that are in that plant and then turning the sugars into lactic acid. And the lactic acid, as it acidifies the food, protects it against rot. I mean, it is kind of a form of rot, but it's a managed rot. And that preserves the food for a very long time. And they found these burial pits of, you dig a hole in the earth. And in Korea, they still bury their urns in the earth for kimchi. But in the South Sea Islands, they found a burial pit for cassava, I think it was, or taro, that was 300 years old and still edible. Although I wasn't prepared to try it. So fermented food is a fascinating thing. It's also culturally fascinating that every culture has their ferment. They tend to be very powerfully flavored, and they're acquired tastes. They're the definition of an acquired taste. And I went to South Korea to learn how to make kimchi, and I went to the Kimchi Museum. You laugh, but there are actually two kimchi museums in Seoul and six in the whole country. They're really serious about their kimchi. And I was there in the morning, and there was one kindergarten group after another parading through the Kimchi Museum, watching these dioramas of people making kimchi and these beautiful urns and the different spices and peppers. And I asked the docent, why do you bring kindergartners to a kimchi museum? And she said, with a total deadpan, "Children are not born liking kimchi. They have to learn." And of course they do have to learn, but why do they have to learn? Well, it's culturally so important, and it becomes defining. And I found that every culture has a fermented food. I shouldn't say every culture, that's an overgeneralization. But most cultures have a fermented food that they love that other cultures think is kind of disgusting. And so it's definitional in opposition. So like if you go to China, the Chinese think cheese, even a cheddar, a mild cheese, is absolutely disgusting. They can't believe we can eat this stuff. Yet they love stinky tofu, which is really disgusting. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be a cultural relativist on this question. No, it's blocks of tofu that have been submerged in rotten vegetables, just not fermented, rotten vegetables, black, scummy, months.
Yum.
And then they take out the tofu after it's soaked in this for months, and then they fry it, and then they relish it, and they eat it. Although I did notice it's mostly eaten outdoors. So maybe they have a problem with the smell, too.
Well, you're in St. Louis, and you haven't mentioned beer, because that's a big part of the fermentation process, too.
Yeah, well, I learned to make beer, and that's one of the most amazing things that fermentation gives us. And it's not just beer, you know. I mean, wine and mead and all these alcohols are made strictly by the action of one microbe, which I think we should consider man's best friend. It's so far superior to the dog in what it's offered us. Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Which also gives us bread. I mean, it's a really interesting microbe. Very dependent on us. We're now very dependent on us, on it. And we're in this very tight symbiotic relationship. I mean, you basically take a mush of grain and you can ferment it pretty easily. And so learning how to make beer, I mean, I never got that good at it. You know, my first beer, I was very proud of it. Tasted like beer, you know, gave you a buzz and had bubbles. Everything I was looking for. But I brought it down to this brewmaster who I was working with, and I gave him one very proudly, and he opens it up, and he sniffs it and says, "Getting a little off note there. Yeah, you getting that Band-Aid? I'm getting Band-Aid off your beer." And as soon as he said it, I mean, there's a way in which the right metaphor to describe a smell suddenly unlocks it for you, and I could never enjoy it again.
You know, I was just looking at my notes here because in talking about beer, you had an observation saying the desire for beer, and I think you said that alcohol is probably the first thing that mankind, or humankind, I should say, fermented. But you say that the desire for beer led from the hunter-gatherer to the farmer.
Yeah, it's a very interesting theory in archaeology right now that suggests, you know, there's been a lot of questions about why did we begin growing things and settling down to do it. It was much easier being a hunter-gatherer. You didn't have to work as hard, less disease. There are many advantages to being a hunter-gatherer. And it wasn't clear that all the animals were gone and there was nothing left to eat. But one thing you couldn't get in nature was a good fermentable substrate, which is to say, a good source of sugar to ferment into alcohol. There was honey, but honey was hard to get. And honey is the easiest kind of alcohol, and probably the first. You take any honey, dilute it about 3 or 4 to 1, it will spontaneously start fermenting. But to get a reliable source of something to ferment, you need to have agriculture. And we have some really good evidence in Central America that the first people who ate corn, bringing us back to my corn obsession, they were drinking it, they weren't eating it. And we know this from looking at their bones and the carbon isotopes, that they're isotopes for the sugars, but not for any of the protein in corn. And that should be there too. Mm. And what that suggests is they were fermenting it and using it as alcohol. So there is a very good chance that we settle down in order to drink, not to eat.
Staying with the microbes and bacteria for a moment, what are they doing inside our body?
Well, you know, that was the interesting leap for me, is that these fermentations going on outside our body are mirrored inside our body, and that you have, I don't know if you know it, Dom, you're only 10% human. You're 90% microbes, and most of them are living in your large intestine. And what they're doing there, we're just starting to learn. But it turns out they're critically involved in your health. And without them, you would not have an immune system. You would not live very long. And we depend on these microbes. And we've been at war with bacteria in our culture since Pasteur. And that war has given us some great things. It's extended our lifespan. It has conquered infectious diseases. But it's also led to chronic disease. And it's led to allergy. And it's led to asthma. And all these kind of things that we now think may be the result of disordering that community. Because it really is an ecosystem. It's an ecological community. It has a very complex structure. It doesn't look like much. But so we're just starting to learn. And a lot of the most important work is going on in this town, at Washington University, in the lab of someone named Jeffrey Gordon, who's done a lot of pioneering work figuring out the links between the gut community and obesity and other chronic diseases.
Even mental illness.
Yeah. Your gut bugs manufacture neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, and your mood is probably affected, as is your appetite. They're deciding when you're going to eat.
What can we do to maintain this order in our gut?
Well, it's something I'm writing about right now, actually. I'm doing a piece for The Times that'll be out next week on this subject. One of the great problems, this brings us back to processed food in the Western diet, is that we've processed food so much that it feeds the 10% of you, but it doesn't feed the 90% that are microbes. So we have a diet of very readily absorbed sugars and fats that basically we absorb in the small intestine very quickly. And very little is left for that fermentation, that inner fermentation. Very little fiber, very little plant matter. And probably the single best thing you can do is I had this moment. I was trying to get all these scientists to make some recommendations, and they're very nervous about doing that because the science is really early. And I finally got a microbiologist at Stanford. You know, I said, come on, you know a lot. I'm sure you're changing the way you're eating. What can I tell people about how to eat if you really want to cultivate your microbiome? And he said, all right, I'm going to tell you my 3 rules. And I got really excited, and I took out my pad, and I start writing. I'm in his lab at Stanford, and he says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. It's
like, where have I heard that before?
I wanted something new. But what he was saying is a good, solid, traditional diet is the best thing you can do. You don't have to do anything fancy. And fermented foods are very good for it, too. And actually, this particular microbiologist and several of the ones I interviewed said there's a really good case for dirtying up your diet, which is a phrase I hadn't heard, getting more bacteria in your diet. And I said, so you mean like not washing produce? And he said, no, I wouldn't do that unless it's from your own garden, because who knows what's on produce? And who knows, there might be pesticide residues. But he said, no, the best way to dirty up your diet is to eat fermented food, because they have huge amounts of probiotic bacteria, much more than you get in a pill.
You had an example in the book, and I've forgotten exactly what the context was, other than the someone put some E. coli into something that's being fermented.
Sister Noel.
Please tell that story.
Yeah. Well, you know, I met all these fermentos. These are people obsessed with fermentation. It's a really interesting subculture. You know, there's a bacterial culture and there's a human culture of fermentation. And one of the most impressive was a woman named, a nun named Sister Noella, who makes cheese, a very traditional French cheese called Saint-Nectaire. She's making it in Connecticut at an abbey there. And she learned it from a woman who learned it from a mother and, you know, down the age, you know, 400-year-old technique used in the Auvergne. And basically, you make your cheese in a wooden barrel with a wooden paddle. Now, if you're the public health department, if you're the FDA, this is terrifying. I mean, we make all our cheese now in stainless steel. And that's our kind of objective correlative of hygienic. You know, you can sanitize it, or at least it looks like it, you know, it gleams. And they were telling her, you can't make cheese in a wooden barrel and sell it to people. And she said, I think it's safer. And she wanted to demonstrate this. So she actually went to graduate school and got a PhD in microbiology at the University of Connecticut. And as part of her work there, she cooked up this really great experiment for the health inspector. She took a vat of raw milk, and they get it from their cows right on the abbey, and put one 5-gallon vat in stainless steel and another 5 gallons in her wooden barrel. Now, the thing you need to know about this wooden barrel is the instructions that have been handed down from generation to generation say, don't wash it, just rinse it lightly. Also terrifying to the health inspector. Then she deliberately inoculated both batches of milk with E. coli and waited 4 hours. And in the stainless steel vat, the E. coli bloomed. I mean, there was an explosion of E. coli, and it was toxic. I mean, nobody could eat it. And in the wooden barrel, the E. coli levels were vanishingly small. It just couldn't take off. And the reason was that there were lactobacillus living in the wooden barrel. And what they do, as soon as, you know, lactobacillus, they loved lactose. And they digest the sugars in the milk, lactose, and turn them into lactic acid, acidifying the milk and killing the E. coli. So you realize these traditional cheesemakers were practicing a kind of folk microbiology for hundreds of years that was keeping them safe. And that under some circumstances, the switch to the hygienic material made the product more dangerous. So she made her case, and she's still making beautiful cheese in a wooden barrel. And I learned how to make it with her.
You're listening to author-journalist Michael Pollan talking about his new book, Cooked. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Michael Pollan. We're talking about his new book, Cooked.
A question I have for you, you're on this extensive book tour, 18 cities. What do you eat, and how do you eat? I mean, you're on the go.
Well, I just had a protein bar in the green room.
Examine the contents very closely, I noticed.
I did. Yeah. I do read ingredient labels a little bit obsessively. You know, when you're on the road, it's really hard to eat. And I've been talking about the virtues of home-cooked food and eating restaurant food at the same time. So, you do what you can. I have a couple, on the other hand, I notice I've been losing weight on this book tour rather than gaining weight, so that's good. But I don't go to the buffet at any hotel for breakfast. I think that's really trouble. I always have oatmeal for breakfast in a hotel. And I never eat meat in airports. That's a good rule of thumb. Never eat meat in airports. It's hard to find good meat in an airport. And so I tend to eat vegetarian when I'm on the road. Although tonight I might have barbecue.
Where are you going?
It's a long story.
I won't ask. I thought maybe you knew a good barbecue place that we didn't. Just before we go to the audience for questions, I'll complete the circle here and go back to the beginning of the social aspect of this whole cooking thing. Because you tell a very touching story in the book, as you have in some of your interviews, with regard to it really gave you an opportunity to communicate with family.
Yeah, I think cooking is really a very powerful glue in the family. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is my son was a couple years away from college when I started it. He's now in college. And I wanted a book that I could, I'd be home more than often. And that I wanted a book on a subject that he was engaged with. And he likes to cook. And he worked in a restaurant for a couple years in the kitchen as an intern. He was a very problematic eater growing up. He was one of these kids who only ate white food for 8 years. But when he discovered food, he really discovered it, and he loves it now, everything but fish. So I thought that, you know, this was a good book to do now in my life, and that I was able to draw him into it. And he loved, I mean, one way to connect with a teenager is brew beer with them and drink it. That's very popular. And it's a two-person job anyway, so we would do that on Saturdays. And, you know, he just got in the habit that we would cook in the kitchen. My wife and I usually cook together, and we have an island, and he would sit at the island and do his homework. And I'd usually try to get him to do something. I think it's really important. I think we're really letting kids off the hook on chores these days because we're so obsessed with their schoolwork and their sports and their success. And I think we're doing them a disservice, actually, because they should leave home knowing how to do the laundry and how to cook. And they don't, many of them. And so even if he had a lot of homework, I would say, well, you should at least chop an onion or mince some garlic. Help me out. And he would.
You say it's a great way to have a conversation because you're not having, quote, the conversation.
Well, the best way to talk to teenagers is not face-to-face the way we're talking, making eye contact. It's working side-by-side without question or driving side-by-side. Yeah, it just flows so much more freely. So we had some of our sweetest times together in the kitchen and in the basement working on our beer, and I think it's a wonderful way to connect with kids. And if you have a kid who's a picky eater, it's a great way to get them to eat. They will eat things they cook themselves that they would never eat. Because a lot of it is their fear of, what are they trying to put over me? What's under that sauce? That sauce must be there to hide something. But if they make it, they see it's, okay, it's the sum of some things I understand and kind of like.
One last question for me, because it's a great story that I have to have you tell, about the microwave, which you cite in many different ways in your book, but you and the family would have occasionally a microwave
evening. Just once.
Well, I know why, but tell our
audience,
please.
That was my son's idea. We'd been doing all these elaborate cooking projects, and he said, hey, how about tonight or tomorrow night, we go to the Safeway, that's our big supermarket, and we each get a microwavable dinner, and we can have whatever we want. And I thought, this could be good for the book. So I said, okay, and we went down and we each picked something out. And my wife got this Stouffer's lasagna, and I got this Amy's vegetable curry. It was another case where I wasn't willing to risk the meat. And Isaac was, you know, and I had trouble finding something that looked good, but he found so many things that looked good. So he got the P.F. Chang's Shanghai stir-fried hoisin beef or something like that. And then he also got the Safeway onion soup gratiné, which was this kind of this rocket cylinder with a brown layer, a toast-colored layer, and a white layer. It looked like a Don King fright wig or something. And this was going to be our meal, and we were going to see how convenient was it, how much time do we save, how much did it cost, all this kind of stuff. And the big lesson, the big takeaway, and it, you know, it tasted kind of like airline food, if you can remember what that was like. It wasn't very good, but the first bite was really good, actually, in all cases. And this food's been engineered for a good first bite, but then it deteriorates. The half-life is about 3 bites, I'd say. So we start microwaving it. And the problem with the microwave is you can only do one thing at a time in it. It's the opposite of the fire we talked about at the beginning, which is communal and shared and draws people together as this wonderful center of gravity. The microwave is the opposite. It's every man for himself. And so it took 40 minutes to get this fast food meal on the table. Now, you can make a meal in 40 minutes. And the reason is that by the time the fourth entree came out of the microwave, the first one was cold. So then my wife had to get up and renew hers, and then we were constantly getting up from the table. And that's the problem with that technology. I describe it, it's the Ayn Rand of appliances, you know. It's everyone for themselves. And it cost $27.
$27.
And you could buy, a farmer's market meal of meat with $27. So it was a real lesson that convenience food is not necessarily as convenient as you think, and that the reason we're attracted to it may have to do with something other than our time crunch, because you really don't save that much time with that kind of food.
Good lesson there. We'll go to the audience for questions now.
And there's somebody with a microphone.
And yes, there is.
Raise
your hand if you have a question, please, of Michael Pollan.
Do you think somebody can be healthy eating just a vegetarian diet? Because I'm a vegetarian, and I've heard people say before that there are certain vitamins and stuff that you can't get without meat.
You can be perfectly healthy on a vegetarian diet. The concern is about vitamin B12, which is only produced by animals. But it's also produced by bacteria. So if you eat fermented food, That is important if you're vegetarian. You get the missing nutrients. Well, if you love kimchi, you're all set. Yeah, you can be very healthy on a vegetarian diet. Don't worry about it.
Over here, please.
Thanks. I'd like to start off just by thanking you for your books, especially The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Thank you.
It quite literally changed my life. I'm a physician, and I still recommend it to a vast majority of my patients. I'd say two-thirds of the visits I have result in some type of conversation about diet and exercise. Most of my patients are not familiar with cooking or even where their food source is from, so I use your books as a good resource for them just to get familiar with it.
I commend you on spending that kind of time with your patients talking about that, too, because a lot of doctors are way too, one, don't know enough about nutrition to have the conversation, and don't have the time for the conversation. That's great.
On the downside, my wife maybe doesn't thank you so much. Because anytime this conversation comes up in company, it's a very heated conversation for me. So the company who maybe goes in the other direction. So my question, though, is I just moved from Vermont and lived out there for several years. And it was an absolute brilliant place to be for one of the big reasons being the connection that people have to their land and their food systems out there. And the fact that the industrialized food system out there it's looked down upon, absolutely. I mean, local and seasonal is the norm, and CSAs are the norm. As easy as literally walking to the corner of your street to pick up your CSA and then coming back and bringing your food home with you every night. I guess my question, and I've asked this to a lot of people, I have my own theories on it, but why is that so unique? Why is it so difficult for the rest of the country to adopt a similar model and for us to unplug from our industrialized food chain?
Well, that's a hard question. My guess is, I mean, Vermont became a hotbed partly because of the university supported it at UVM. There's a lot of interesting work on sustainable agriculture, and the universities play a big role in what kind of agriculture we have. And the research agenda there is very different than it is here. I think you also had the fact that agriculture was failing in Vermont and had to be reinvented. And a crisis is often an opportunity for change. And, you know, the kind of corn and soy agriculture here hasn't suffered the way dairy in New England has suffered. And the need to figure out another way to make it, I think, bred a lot of innovation. That would be a hypothesis. I'm not absolutely sure that that's what happened. And there was a market. I mean, there were a lot of urbanites in Vermont, oddly enough. I mean, refugees from cities who were willing to pay money for this food. But it's not a good landscape for industrialized agriculture. It's too hilly. It's too mountainous. But, you know, what you saw there is happening in many, many corners of the country. I mean, it's certainly happening in Northern California. And it's happening in the Hudson Valley in New York. And I think you're going to see it in more and more places. I mean, it's the part of the food system that's growing and is relatively healthy. It's still tiny relative to the whole thing. Just to one point on doctors and these issues, I didn't mention one of the inspirations of this book was a cardiologist who wrote me when I was writing Food Rules. You know, Food Rules is kind of my crowdsourced book. I asked lots of people to propose food rules. And in fact, that book was initially, doctors had said, you know, can you make a poster or something that I could hang up with your food rules? And I asked my publisher, can we do a poster? And they said, we don't know how to do a poster. Can we do a little book? So we did a little book instead. But when I was making the solicitation to people, I got an email back from a transplant cardiologist. This is somebody who works with people who've gotten a new heart. And he told me what he does on the last appointment before he sends them out into the world to hopefully take care of their new heart. He takes out his prescription pad, and they're expecting him to write a prescription for Lipitor or something like that. And he instead writes down the recipe for how to roast a chicken, and he hands that to them. Very powerful message. This is what's going to keep you healthy, eating real food. And on the back, he writes what to do on day two with a chicken, you know, how to make tacos, and how to make a soup from the carcass. And it's a beautiful idea, and I imagine if you received it, very powerful. So doctors have such an important role. If they're willing to take up the conversation about food and not talk about nutrients and not go on about saturated fats and, you know, but just talk about food. They have so much cultural authority, and most of them are not using it. Anyway, I commend you for what you're doing.
Michael Pollan, fascinating as usual.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, in light of the recent protests by low-wage workers in St. Louis area restaurants, we'll take a look at the economic impact of raising the minimum wage. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Don Marsh. Thanks for listening.